It's 4:06, and you're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up later in the show, we'll look at a new report that finds that about 1 in 5 American soldiers had a mental illness before enlisting in the Army, and that's got some calling on the Army to take a closer look at their screening process for new recruits.
First, we're talking about celebrity activism. Last week, comedian Seth Rogen testified in front of a Senate Appropriations panel in favor of more funding for Alzheimer's research. His mother-in-law has the disease. His testimony was a little bit of everything, starting out with funny.
I came here today for a few reasons. One, I'm a huge House of Cards fan. Just marathon the whole thing, had to be here.
And the audience, the actor did make his audience laugh clearly, but his story was also poignant and personal.
The third reason I'm here simply is to show people that they're not alone. So few people share their personal stories. So few people have something to relate to. I know that if me and my wife saw someone like me talking about this, it would probably make us feel a little less alone.
Also last week, actor Ben Affleck testified in front of the Senate's Committee on Foreign Relations about the violence in the Democratic Republic of Congo. He's the founder of the Eastern Congo Initiative, a nonprofit advocacy group trying to improve the region.
Celebrities in Congress make headlines, but does it really matter when celebrities support causes? How persuasive are they when they give official testimony? Here to talk about celebrity activism with us is Daryl West. He's Vice President and Director of Governance Studies at the Brookings Institution and co-author of Celebrity Politics. Daryl, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you. Nice to be with you.
Well, we've got George Clooney taking interest in Darfur, Madonna and Oprah fighting for girls' education in Africa, Mark Ruffalo coming out against fracking. The list just keeps going on and getting longer. Why are there so many celebrity activists?
Celebrities love to get involved in these types of causes because it's a way to draw attention, and the media are very interested when these people testify, as evidenced by Seth Rogen's testimony. There were lots of news stories that came out about this, so it's really a great way for them to draw attention to a cause they care about.
So the way you describe it there, it sounds as though they are in it for the right reasons. They're not in there as a PR stunt. They're in there because they want to change something.
They generally do want to change things. Bono, for example, has spoken out about the African debt crisis and the need to address that. Michael J. Fox, of course, has been very visible on the MS issue and the need to do more funding of that disease. So a lot of times people have a personal connection. In Rogen's case, his mother-in-law was suffering from Alzheimer's, and so that motivates their involvement on that particular issue.
How big a difference do celebrities make when they become activists?
They certainly are very good at drawing attention to a cause. Whenever they appear on Capitol Hill to testify, it's standing room only. There are lots of news stories that come out. They're very good at fundraising for particular causes. So when you put their name on a fundraiser, organizations are able to raise a lot more money than they would if they employed a non-celebrity. Whether they actually change minds or change votes in Congress is hard to discern. We have seen certain cases where there was additional funding for various diseases that came about as a result of testimony. But in many cases, you know, it's hard to chart an exact impact that comes out of these kinds of testimonies.
So obviously it's good news if a celebrity signs on to a particular cause. It's good news for that cause. But what about the causes that don't get championed by a celebrity? Is that the dark side, that if you don't have a celebrity attached, you wither on the vine?
Oftentimes, if you don't have a celebrity, your organization is going to wither on the vine. It's hard to get media attention. It's hard to raise money. It's hard to generate a lot of public interest in that particular cause. But the good news is there have been a number of celebrities that have come out, and so there are lots of different causes that now are getting more attention than used to be the case. So that's been a plus for those particular causes.
Does it say anything in particular about our culture that we need a celebrity to be holding the banner to get people to pay attention?
It says a lot about our contemporary culture. We have, after all, become a celebrity culture. When you look at the types of stories that attract a lot of attention, when you look at Twitter and Facebook and who drives traffic and who's able to develop huge followings. It's the rich and famous. Those are the people who drive celebrity news coverage. And so we shouldn't be surprised, given that fact, that it spills over into the political arena and the world of governance, that becomes the next territory for celebrities to engage. And we're seeing a lot of that in recent years.
Seth Rogen, we heard a couple of clips from his testimony on Alzheimer's when we began the segment here, and he was funny, and there were a lot of people there. His audience was engaged, but there were only two senators there, and you sort of wonder if we keep relying on celebrities to draw people to the cause, whether we could also get desensitized to celebrities, and then some of these causes, which are important and have life and death sometimes hanging in the balance, whether they could suffer as a result.
Well, if there were two senators there, sometimes that's twice as many as typically is the case at a Senate hearing. Many Senate hearings don't attract a lot of participation from senators because they serve on multiple committees. Oftentimes, there are different hearings taking place at the same time, so that's not very unusual. If the senator's staffs are there, it still provides a vehicle for the celebrity to have impact because the staff does a lot of the work of Congress. They help to write the bills. They are kind of the eyes and ears for the senator. So the celebrity can still have impact in that kind of situation.
Do you have a sense of how seriously politicians take these celebrities who testify in front of them?
I think it varies enormously depending on the senator, on the celebrity. It has to be a celebrity who is not just a big name, but someone who has studied up on the issue and really developed some expertise. If it's a celebrity who just speaks out on an issue, but that person doesn't really know very much, then that person is going to have no impact and it's not going to be taken seriously. And there certainly are examples like that. But most of the celebrities that you mentioned here, George Clooney, Ben Affleck, these are people who've taken the time to study on their particular issue. Clooney, for example, has traveled to Darfur on any number of occasions. So he has visited the region. He's talked with the experts there. He's seen firsthand what some of the issues are. And so I think when someone puts in that kind of time and effort, that gives them a credibility that goes beyond their name.
Well, I was going to say Angelina Jolie. It seems like she's the gold standard when it comes to celebrity activists. She seems to be held in extremely high regard. What is she doing right and what is she doing differently than other celebrity activists who don't quite rise to her level?
Well, she's an example of someone who has put the time and effort in. She has had many visits to Africa. She has spoken out a lot on that issue, but she has really developed a lot of knowledge and expertise on that particular issue. And so when she speaks out on the issue, it attracts a lot of attention and people take it seriously because people understand that she has put a lot of effort into that. And so for other celebrities who want to emulate that model, that's what they have to do. You know, it's not just a matter of showing up in Washington and speaking out at a hearing. They have to really study that issue and know what they're talking about. Otherwise, nobody's going to take them seriously.
Do you worry at all about causes that are in the market for a celebrity champion? They want Angelina Jolie. Instead, they get somebody from Jersey Shore. And as a result, they suffer.
There is a marketplace for celebrities. There are trade associations of celebrities that basically match celebrities with political causes. And so obviously there are the A-list, the B-list, and the C-list celebrities, and everybody wants the A-list of people because that's where you can raise the money and that's where you can generate the most media coverage. You know, there are very few people at that level. So most causes have to make do if they're interested in having a celebrity spokesperson with someone down that list a little bit.
All right, Daryl, thank you so much for coming on today.
Thank you.
We've been talking to Daryl West. He's vice president and director of governance studies at the Brookings Institution and co-author of Celebrity Politics. He was with us to talk about celebrity activism.
A new report out today is raising questions over the military's assessment and screening of their recruits. The study, which is the largest to date, showed that nearly 1 in 5 American soldiers had a common mental illness before enlisting in the military.
And during their military service, soldiers' rates of most psychiatric disorders climbed well past civilian levels. And that's got many wondering how those recruits got into the military in the first place and what's being done to help them when their service is over.
The study also looked at military suicide and found it's occurring not only in currently and previous deployed soldiers, but also among those never deployed at all. Joining us now is Craig Bryan. He's the executive director of the National Center for Veteran Studies. He's also a clinical psychologist and an assistant professor in the Department of Psychology at the University of Utah. Craig, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
So the big focus here is, or a big part of the big focus here is trying to deal with the military suicide issue. What are the rates of suicide in the American military?
Well, over the past decade or so, the rates of suicide have increased. They've more than doubled. And within the past couple of years, depending on the branch of service, there's some differences. But overall, it's about 20 per 100,000, which is just a little bit higher than what we would see in a similar general population, United States rate of about 19 per 100,000.
My gut reaction to that would be to think, well, being in the military is more stressful. It would be natural that there'd be a higher rate of suicide, but that's not the historical norm, is it?
Correct. Yeah. Traditionally, suicide rates among service members are typically lower than age and gender matched suicide rates in the general population.
According to the studies that came out today, people who joined the military come in with much higher rates of mental illness than the general public. Do I have that right, Craig? And was that surprising to you?
It was not actually too surprising. Research with our own studies here at the National Center for Veteran Studies have actually found similar high rates of pre-existing health conditions and pre-existing suicidal thoughts and suicide behaviors. I think the reports that were released this week, though, are definitely the largest scale and probably the most well-designed to date. So it certainly gives a lot more confidence to some of these results that we've actually been finding over the past few years.
What kind of mental disorders are we talking about? They said a lot of common mental illnesses, common among the regular, the civilian population. What are we talking about there?
Right. So this would be things such as major depressive disorder, generalized anxiety disorder, post-traumatic stress disorder, substance use disorders, ADHD, et cetera. I mean, kind of the typical mental health or psychiatric conditions that we would typically talk about or think of on a day-to-day basis.
And the first action item this raises is there more that should be done to screen recruits up front?
Right. Well, that's a tricky question, actually. And the reason for that is because the methods that we use to screen people for histories of health conditions and problems are self-report. And so if you want to join the military, you go to a military entrance processing station, and then you'll fill out a questionnaire. It's very similar to whenever any of us goes to the doctor. We just, you know, check the yes box if there's a history of it, check the no box if there's not. Well, if you know that the job that you are applying for is going to screen you out, if you check certain yes boxes, then there's a strong motivation to not report those problems or not report those conditions. And unfortunately, this is, I think, one of the biggest limitations that we have in screening right now, both within and external to the military, is we completely rely on self-report.
Well, and on the other hand, it may well be that some recruit might have ADHD or a depression-related disorder or any of the other things you listed and still make a very good soldier. And you might be
Correct.
Discriminating and screening out people who might never have a problem.
Right, exactly. And that's the other caveat when, you know, this whole issue of, well, we just need to screen more people out, that's the issue that I immediately bring up, is that we actually are not very good at predicting which service members or which recruits are going to then have difficulties, make a suicide attempt 10, 15 years into the future. The reality is that most of the service members who come in with these pre-existing health conditions actually do quite fine. They're quite successful, and they go on and have a very, you know, high-quality, successful military career. And so it's not as simple as just you know, improving screening and just screening out anyone who checks certain yes boxes, we're just not good enough yet at predicting why some people will go on to have problems and others will not.
So bringing it around to this main question, why do we see this increase in suicide rate? Does the concept that more recruits are coming in with problems right at the outset, does that really explain much?
Well, so one of the papers that was released this week actually kind of addressed that issue, and that was a common question that many of us had in the United States was, well, you know, there for a while we were hurting in terms of our recruitment of new service members, and so let's give out more waivers. So if you have a pre-existing health condition that would have eliminated you from consideration or employment in the military, we'll give you a waiver. We'll let you in anyway. And what one of these studies actually found was that, no, that actually doesn't explain the increase in suicides that we've seen over the past decade. And so we've been able to kind of rule that out as one of the potential contributors, which I think will help us to focus on other areas that might get us closer to the answer.
Well, another obvious question is there something about the wars we've been involved in, Afghanistan and Iraq, that is making more of our military service people commit suicide?
Right. I would say that's actually been the burning question, the number one question for the past 10 years or so. And by and large, research to date does not really support that those who deploy are more likely to die by suicide, to attempt suicide, etc. What many of us have been working on over the past few years is, you know, maybe we're asking the wrong question. And so the question, is it because of deployments? That's not sort of a specific enough question. And so we're starting to ask now, well, for whom is deployment a risk factor? So some people who deploy, that experience can increase their risk, but for many others, it does not. And actually, in one of the reports that was released this week, you actually kind of see some now evidence starting to support that more complex question. So, for instance, one of the more notable findings was that female service members have a significantly increased likelihood of dying by suicide while they are deployed. But once they're in the United States, whether before a deployment or after returning from a deployment, we don't see increased risk.
I've also heard arguments over the years that increased risk of PTSD or brain injury, people who maybe would have died in a previous war survive, but with some kind of brain injury could account for psychological problems, maybe suicide.
Correct. Yeah, that's actually, I think, a really important point. And we had published a study within the past year out of the National Center here showing that service members who had sustained multiple traumatic brain injuries, so had been blasted or had been in accidents, lost consciousness, or were dazed and confused after a head injury, if they experience that multiple times, two or more times during their lives, the severity of their depression, anxiety would increase steadily. We also saw that those who had multiple traumatic brain injuries were more likely to have suicidal thoughts. And so there's actually now kind of a growing scientific attention towards this notion of not just the psychological injuries associated with war, but what are sort of the complexities and the issues arising from that. And so that kind of gets back to that notion of, well, for whom would deployment be a risk factor for suicide? Well, at least some of the research is suggesting that those who sustain repetitive multiple traumatic brain injuries might be at increased risk.
Is there also thought that maybe it's the type of deployment, what you're doing when deployed, or the length, or how many terms of deployment you have affect suicide risk?
Right. So there have actually been a number of studies that have been published that show that some of those variables do make a difference when it comes to psychological health. So, for instance, the longer that you have deployed or the more often you've deployed, we tend to see increases in depression, PTSD, severity, etc. We've not yet seen kind of this that translate into increased risk for suicides. Now, the report that came out today showed that for soldiers who had repeated, as they kind of went from 0 to 1, 1 to 2, 2 to 3 plus deployments, as the number of deployments increased, there was an incremental increase in the risk of suicide. However, it wasn't large enough that we could definitively say, and there's an effect. It sort of wasn't quite significant enough. So I think we still have to be kind of cautious about making that conclusion.
We're talking with Craig Bryan about mental health, suicide in the military. Coming up, we'll talk about treatment and what's available for people in the military. We're talking with Craig Bryan about mental health in the military. A new report out today shows 1 in 5 American soldiers had a common mental illness of one sort or another before enlisting. And the new reports out today try to come to grips with rising suicide rates in the U.S. military. You can join at 800-642-1234. Do you think the military should be stricter in screening, provide more treatment? What is the solution to these problems? Give a call at 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. Craig, before we go to our callers, I'd like to ask about mental health treatment in the military. Is there a feeling that there needs to be more available for our troops?
Well, I think one of the questions is enough available? But I think probably a more important question is, what is the type of treatment that's been provided? And so there are a number of studies that are actually getting pretty close to wrapping up. We actually just finished a study ourselves looking at conditions like PTSD, suicide risk, et cetera. And many of these treatments are actually doing much better than standard existing mental health therapies. And so when I kind of hear that question, is it that we need better access, I would just qualify it to say, well, we need better access to treatments that work. And some treatments clearly work better than others, but unfortunately, many mental health professionals in our country, both in and out of the military, have not been trained to use these more effective therapies.
And that would be a big change to make.
Oh, absolutely. And it's a big change because it would require a complete sort of paradigm shift at the training institutions for all of the mental health professions. So we would not only need to teach these therapies to those who are just starting the careers, but also try to convince those who have been practicing mental health treatment for many years to consider changing the way that they go about doing business. And I think that latter task is actually, I've found, to be the more challenging one.
You mentioned earlier that someone, when they're entering the military, isn't probably going to be prone to self-report and risk being left out of the military to begin with. Is there a stigma that leads soldiers to not seek medical attention for mental health issues once they're in the military?
Oh, certainly. I think a number of surveys have been done with military personnel, and the number one cited reason for why I will not go to treatment as a service member is that there will be some sort of perceived negative impact on my career, whether I'll be kicked out of the military, I won't be promoted, I'll be demoted, et cetera. And then you find other reports of, fear that others will see me as weak, they'll treat me negatively, et cetera.
We'll go to our callers now. We've got Joe on the line in Prairie du Chien. Joe, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, I'm curious. I'm wondering how the political situation and the conflicts or engagements of whatever kind that our military personnel are involved in play into their feelings, and how that might impact the discussion we're having.
Joe, thanks. Excuse me. Thanks for the call. What do you think, Craig?
Well, I think it could potentially have an impact. It's kind of interesting because even when I was in the military, many people have asked me this question, sort of how do political views weigh on your experience as a service member? And what, I would reply, and what many service members reply, is it's sort of like you got to kind of compartmentalize that part of who you are, because if you allow yourself to get too caught up in sort of the social or political aspects, then it could potentially cause considerable distress. And I've certainly, as a practicing psychologist, treated many service members for whom their distress was related to questions about sort of the meaning and the purpose of it. Why are we here? Was this worth it, et cetera? And we're actually kind of conducting some studies right now to look at how the impact of exposure to a variety of traumatic and deployment-related variables that don't necessarily conform to one's moral code can influence one's health and well-being overall.
Thanks for the call. We'll go to Mike in Milwaukee now. Mike, you're on the air.
Hi. I agree with your guest that perhaps there is not the most appropriate treatment strategy, because certainly there is treatment. And with that being said, I think that one thing is that with the advancement of our technology, we think that if we arm our troops with the latest weapons and the latest computer systems, that they'll be more protected. And that's true, but none of that deals with what they actually see and how they actually feel about it. And I served in the military, and you're basically instructed in tactical methods, not necessarily how you process, you know, and when somebody gets shot, there's not a, you know, nobody goes, is put on administrative leave, say like they are for like domestic police force. So then the last thing I wanted to say is I completely reject the idea that we should look at, you know, well, these soldiers had something wrong with them before they enlisted. That's a cop-out. Thank you.
Thanks for the call, Mike. Brought up a lot there. First of all, that idea that, hey, they had problems and they came into the military is a cop-out, Craig Bryan. What do you think of that?
Yeah, it's a sentiment that actually I hear from a lot of people. But I think the reason why there's kind of that, you know, kind of that reaction of it's a cop-out is I think sometimes what that is interpreted as meaning is like, well, that's the reason or that's the excuse for, you know, whatever problem. And it is actually kind of the other side of the coin that I do worry about is that it almost gives people permission to write off the suffering that many service members and veterans are having. But I think the reality is that there are a certain number, not all, and definitely not the majority of service members, but there is a small but considerable subset of service members who carry with them when they enter into the military, you know, just difficult situations, past experiences in their life, and those things certainly have an impact on them as they serve.
And Mike brought up the issue of training, and that adds another, a third wheel to the approach, screening up front, treatment when there are problems. But is it possible to proactively build a sense of resilience in what's going to be a traumatic situation that might help deal with these problems and ultimately maybe bring down the suicide rate?
Right. So that's another question that many people have been asking over the past 10 years, and unfortunately, there was actually a report released by the Institute of Medicine just 2 weeks ago that was not very positive. And basically what the conclusion of the report is that despite lots of resources being focused towards this issue of prevention, we actually don't have any indication that any of those efforts are really working right now, although there are some promising leads, for instance, the Battle Mind program that was developed by the Army. Now, another aspect of this for prevention, there's actually one really well-supported prevention strategy. It's called stress inoculation training, and this has been shown over decades to reduce the likelihood of PTSD following exposure to a highly stressful event. And most of the military's training, although it's not explicitly described as stress inoculation training, the concepts of exposing service members to increasingly more difficult, more stressful situations and teaching them how to master their thoughts and their feelings and their physical reactions, that is the essence of stress inoculation training. And so the interesting thing and the question I've often wondered is, if we did not have basic training, if we did not have combat arms training, etc., what would the PTSD rates be then? And my guess would be much, much higher than what they are now, because if you don't prepare people for the rigors of everyday life in the military, it's extremely stressful, and we would probably see actually much higher rates of psychological injury and suicide.
Looking at things at the other end, when people leave the military, these problems aren't left behind. What do we know about the experience of veterans once they leave active duty in dealing with mental illness and suicide?
So I think we often underestimate the challenges that are associated with transitioning out of the military. And so many service members and many veterans often feel like now that they have left this system, and it's a, you know, the military system is a culture. It has its own rules, its own way of doing things, its expectations, it's a hierarchy. It really is its own unique subculture within the United States, and it's very different from how sort of we do things in the general population. And so when many service members transition out and they take a new job or they go to school, so most of our work's been focused on the veterans who go into college, they can actually find that sometimes they feel out of place. And some of our preliminary research is showing that this sort of feeling isolated and feeling like I don't fit in or I don't belong is actually a really important risk factor. Whereas those who feel like they do fit in with some kind of group, whether it's with another group of veterans, whether it's another group of students on campus, whether it's with their family, that sense of belongingness actually protects them and really helps them to succeed.
Are there ways to facilitate that connectedness when people make the transition back into civilian life?
Oh, absolutely. I think, you know, so I think one of the things that we very easily do in our society is when service members transition out of the military, we sort of expect them to abandon their life experiences up to that point. And we say, you know, it's very common for veterans to hear from others, you know, you're not in the military anymore, so stop doing that, you know, in a sort of disparaging or a critical way. And we often have this expectation of, well, you have to now conform to our world, which oftentimes I think is somewhat unfair to veterans, because here we have, you know, ask them to do things on behalf of the nation, whether or not we agree with the reasons for what they're doing. But they have basically served in a high-stress, high-demand career field on our behalf. They live in a different system. And then after that period of service is over, I think it's unfair to kind of ask them to just pretend like it never happened, and to just kind of get on with things so that we don't have to kind of deal with that and talk about it anymore. And I think my experience is that talking with civilians, they don't intend to come off that way. But when you talk to veterans, oftentimes that's how many of them experience it, is it's this unintentional sort of dismissal of their life experiences and who they feel they are as a person.
Craig, thanks a lot for taking time with us today.
My pleasure.
That's Craig Bryan. He's executive director of the National Center for Veteran Studies. We've been talking with him about new studies that looked at mental health and suicide in the U.S. military. It's time for our Teach Me What You Know segment. Every week we learn a new skill, like how to write a novel or how to change careers. Today we're learning how to do something that's on a lot of people's minds this time of year, taxes.
Tom Milliken is our guest. He's a principal at SVA, a certified public accounting firm in Madison. Tom, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
So tax day is officially Tuesday, April 15th. And if we haven't started yet or finished yet, I don't know, are we slackers? Are we hopeless?
I don't think so. It's actually been not that long since the IRS is all set up with their computers and is ready to accept returns. So I think it's really the time to get going right now.
So for those of us who have maybe not done them, doing them for the first time, what is the first step?
Well, I think the first step in preparing your tax returns is to assemble all of the records that you're going to need to do that. You know, today, most sources of income are actually reported by the payor of that income. Reported to you on a W-2 form or a 1099 form or some other kind of reporting document, and that same information is also reported to the Internal Revenue Service and the Wisconsin Department of Revenue. So when you file your returns, I think it's important that you make sure that any information returns that you've received, that you certainly report that income on the return, because the government has that information already, and if you don't report it, they'll generally end up assessing you at some time in the future. I guess the hardest part is to identify those things that might help you in your taxes, those items that might be eligible for a deduction, real estate taxes, property tax payments, charitable contributions, interest expense that you might pay on a mortgage, tuition that you might be paying for higher education. Those things may not necessarily be reported to you, so it's important that you keep good records.
And looking at these documents, you mentioned some of them. Are there any others that tend to slip through the cracks? And also, we know about the W-2 form, but what sorts of documents are we talking about in general?
For example, you might have Form 1099-R to report distributions that you receive from retirement plans or from IRAs. There's a 1098-T that reports tuition and fees that you pay to or that you've paid for higher education expenses. Those are ones that oftentimes go unnoticed.
So one big decision to make pretty early on, I imagine, is am I going to try to do this myself or get some professional help? What kind of circumstances do you think would lead us to not go it alone?
You know, today there are really a lot of good software packages out there. Probably the most commonly used one is TurboTax, and that software costs, I would say, about between $65 and $75, depending on where you buy it. And that software will actually prompt you through a series of questions to try to uncover all of those items of income and deductions that you might be available to you, and kind of prompt you on what information that you need. And so I think, you know, people that, you know, a lot of wage earning people that might have some investment accounts, bank accounts, whatever, can pretty much do returns on their own. You can actually go out onto the IRS website, and there is a link to about 14 different self-preparation software packages that you can access. And if your income is below a certain level, I think it's like $58,000, you can actually do your returns for free on that thing. Where you might need to get help from a professional is if you have investments in, say, a corporation that's taxed as an S corp, or a partnership where you're receiving a form K-1 with a lot of information that you have to report on your return, and it's not normal type stuff, so you might not know where to report it. If you are a beneficiary of a trust and receive distributions from a trust, that might be another situation. If you're the owner of a business and you're self-employed, you've got to report all the income and expenses from that business. But if you have assets that are used in the business and you need to depreciate those assets, there's several alternative ways that you can calculate that depreciation. Some are more beneficial than others. So if you're looking to minimize your taxes and you have some somewhat complicated decisions to make, I think that might be the time when you want to look for a professional tax preparer.
It's interesting because among some people I know, they get their taxes done professionally, and it's sort of the sense that if you do them yourself, you're risking losing out on a lot of money. And if you pay to have it done, well, the tax preparer can find a lot of things that will save you money that you, the uninitiated, would never have found for yourself. Is that not true? Is it pretty easy to do it yourself? I'm not losing $500 by doing it myself?
I think that for many people that are get a W-2 because they're earning wages and they have a bank account, maybe some limited amount of investments, particularly if they're not itemizing deductions, they're very capable of doing returns themselves. Where you might need some help is, let's say you've got children in college and there are various alternative tax credits or deductions that are available for qualified higher education expenses, and trying to determine which one of those various available credits, you have to choose one or the other, and the IRS doesn't tell you which one you should claim, so it really involves having to calculate those benefits several different ways and try to determine which one gives you the best result, and then that's what you claim on your tax return. So that might be a situation where somebody is losing out. But I think if someone doesn't own a home, for example, so they don't have a mortgage or real estate taxes, generally that person would not be itemizing deductions. They would be claiming a standard deduction, standard personal exemption, and all of their income is reported to them on information returns such as W-2s and 1099s. I think most people would be pretty self-sufficient preparing their own returns.
I think a lot of people may go in with a lot of fear that maybe they'll make an honest mistake and then the dreaded audit comes along and they'll be dragged away in chains or something. How much fear should we have of an IRS audit down the road?
You know, I think, of course, I've been working with the IRS or against the IRS for 30 years, so I may have a different view on this. But my experience is people fear the IRS a lot more than they should. And no one wants to get that letter in the mail from the Internal Revenue Service saying they owe some money for something. A lot of times, you just need to provide more information to the IRS. But I think with IRS notices or from the Department of Revenue, that might be a time when you do want to go to get some help from a professional, because we're used to dealing with those types of things. The IRS is not always right. Sometimes they make a mistake. Sometimes they just need more information. And I think the tendency that people that aren't familiar with the IRS, they get an assessment notice in the mail, and they just go ahead and pay it without just assuming that they're wrong. And I think more times than not, further explanation or further correspondence with the IRS will resolve the problem in the taxpayer's favor.
All right. So don't be afraid of the tax man or the tax persons. All right, Tom, well, thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure. I'm glad you had me today.
We've been talking with Tom Milliken, principal at SVA, a certified public accounting firm in Madison. He was with us for Teach Me What You Know on how to prepare your taxes.